The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
the beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan.
Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world. I will oppose you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
From the heartland of America, welcome. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we are, let's see, what is today's
date? Today's the 26th of February.
The 26th of February. Boy, time is just, 2012 is flying.
Science will figure out soon that the older you get, the faster time really moves. Some property of physics that we don't yet understand.
I have to say, because time is compressed, we need to just get right to our guests. No, yes. Blather today.
A special program today, sort of a PID radio roundtable. These were really enjoyable when we had the chance to do these in Branson, Missouri at the Future Congress last year. We'll get a chance to do that again in Branson this year for the
Prophecy and the News Conference.
That is correct, in July, and a couple of the folks.
That we'll get the corrected name for that here in a minute.
Yes. But we were very pleased and honored to have the opportunity to meet a couple of these fellows at various conferences over the last couple of years. The first, the publisher of the excellent website Logos Apologia, which you find online at logosapologia.org. Is it the org or the com? It is
org.
Chris Putnam. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Derek and Sharon. It's great to be on the show.
Well, we're all flying here. We just all got back from church, so we're just the seat of the pants as per usual. And the second, our good friend, publisher of Raiders News, and some excellent collaborative books: Pandemonium's Engine, God's Ghostbusters, and books that he has written himself, which have been really groundbreaking. Apollyon Rising, Nephilim, Stargates among them.
He's a slacker.
Horn. Yeah. Tom, you say you've been trying to retire for about the last 10 years?
Yeah, just I want to become just a big, fat slacker. And it has not been working out very well at all. And I've gave up promising my wife that, okay, you know, when I get past this year, that's it. I remember last year speaking at one of Chuck Missler's events, and I promised my family, I said, at the end of the year, that's it. And we came into January with something like 4 conferences scheduled, 20 book projects that we've got in the pipeline this year, at least 1 documentary film. So I don't know. I myself am not a very good prophet.
Well, getting through this year is kind of the theme of this program. As we know, 2012 has been pointed to by many for various reasons, and as Christians, we have every right and reason to be skeptical of why our attention is being focused on 2012. But you two fellows, Chris and Tom, have co-authored a forthcoming book that talks about a prophecy that is only now, I think, becoming more widely known, and that is the prophecy of Saint Malachi. The book called Petrus Romanus: The Final Pope Is Here. So just for those who may not be familiar with St. Malachi and the prophecy of the popes and why we're looking at what may be the coming of the final pope in the line sitting in the Vatican, tell us, you know, who was St. Malachi and what did he prophesy? And then we can go on to why does it matter?
St. Malachi was a prophet in the 12th century, a Catholic prophet from Ireland. And as the story goes, and it's pretty much a legend, and we don't really have much verification on the actual story. But as the story goes, he made a journey to Rome and met with the Pope, and he wanted to go and retire at this monastery. That didn't really work out. But upon leaving Rome, on a hill, he had a vision of all the popes to the end of time. Okay, and so he wrote down this list of these kind of nebulous Latin phrases, and there was 112 or 111 and a final ending. And the thing that's really interesting is that final ending, which seems to predict the destruction of Rome during the final pope, who is Petrus Romanus. And it mentions Rome as the seven-hilled city, and it talks about its destruction, which really seems to coincide remarkably with Revelation chapter 17. So it really does seem to point to this final pope being the biblical false prophet. And, you know, it, it by just by inference, it seems to connect Rome with Mystery Babylon. So that's why it's a really interesting prophecy, especially in light of we're at 111 now.
So, Tom, how did St. Malachi identify these popes? How do we know that we are up to Pope number 111?
Well, he started at the pope that would be there was an existing pope, and he gave a series of these Latin phrases that would start with the next pope, Pope Celestine II, all the way down to who would be the final pope. That's Peter the Roman or Petrus Romanus, whose reign, as Chris said, would end in the destruction of Rome. That would be the 112th. According to some people's accounting, it's the 111th. According to others, it's 112th. And what I would say to people is that regardless of the number games that might be played, or whether some people view his prophecy as divinely inspired or demonically inspired, we have a 900-year-old prophecy that has come to an end. The very next pope following Benedict XVI is the last pope on this list. So according to that prophecy, he is Petrus Romanus. And in fact, I'll read you the last line in the prophecy. This is what it says. This is the English interpretation. Quote, in extreme persecution, the seat of the Holy Roman Church will be occupied by Peter the Roman, who will feed the sheep through many tribulations. When they are over, the city of Seven Hills will be destroyed, and the terrible or fearsome judge will judge his people. The end. End quote. And of course, he's referring to following the destruction of the seven-hilled city in Rome, then Jesus Christ will, his second coming will occur, and there will be the great judgment. From Catholic eschatology is a little bit different than evangelical eschatology, but that would be the time of what we might think of as the judgment seat of Christ. But that great judgment is coming. Now, if it had only been this one prophecy of the popes made by either Malachi or somebody else who used his name to ascribe these prophecies to, we wouldn't have made very much of it. And in fact, if you read my book, Apollyon Rising 2012, there's only one paragraph that even mentions the prophecy of the popes, and that only because from among the scholars of the implications of the year 2012, and mostly related to the Mayan calendar phenomenon, there have been more than a few that have pointed to this Malachi or Morgair prophecy, saying it appears that it, too, will reach its end in the year 2012. And again, this was one of those things that it seemed like the more I tried to walk away from it, the more there was a redundancy of various cultures, many of whom we have no evidence that they could communicate with one another, and even Christian writers. I mean, Chris Putnam turned over some astonishing stuff. Jonathan Edwards, right, a famous early preacher who preached his famous, you know, sinners in the hands mm-hmm. of an angry God,
right.
Speculating about when the Roman Catholicism would come to an end and the destruction of Rome, and pointing towards the year 2012, and more than him, and that 300 and some years ago. So there's something here that's very unusual that seems to be happening. And with regard to Petrus Romanus, it too seems to be coming to fruition at the same time that you've got Jewish prophecies, Mayan prophecies, Mesoamerican prophecies, speculations from hundreds of years ago from prophetic writers who all, for whatever reason, were being inspired to imagine the year 2012 as a time when the earth will enter into, you know, that evangelical great tribulation, dispensationalism, that the great tribulation period would begin, the false prophet will appear, the Antichrist will appear. 3.5 years later, in potentially the mids of 2016, you're going to have the breaking of the covenant between the Antichrist and Israel, and that's when real, true great tribulation appears. And as we go along in this show, if you want to talk about some of those various cultures that all pointed towards this time and these dates that continue to turn up, 2012 and 2016, after a while, it starts feeling like it is statistically improbable that there wasn't at least an occult force operating behind all these, global inspirations from various cultures over thousands of years, And then the big question, of course, would be, for what purpose? Are we moving towards a time of great deception? What is it all about? And, of course, that's the main thing that intrigues me, is why? Why so many cultures fixated on this date?
Well, I want to get into all of that stuff, all of that good stuff. But before we get there, I want to set a little little basement here. Chris Putnam is your partner on this book, and you said that he brought to you all sorts of research. Chris, I know many of our listeners are familiar with Tom Horn. Chris Putnam may be new to many of you out there. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Chris?
Well, certainly. I'm a dedicated student of the Bible these days. I became a Christian probably only really seriously about 10 years ago, and I really... Once I decided it was true, I threw myself into it wholeheartedly, and I started out studying all of Chuck Missler's tapes, and I probably went through the whole Bible with him, and then I decided to go to seminary, and I went to Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary and took some courses with Michael Heiser there. He's an adjunct professor there.
Really? Oh,
and,
cool.
Yeah, and so I've got my master's degree in theological studies now. And it's funny. I mean, you know, 12 years ago when I showed up at church, I was broken and looking for answers. And now I get to co-teach that same class I showed up to at church. and you know, if you had asked me back then, I never would have thought that that would happen. But one of the things that fascinates me, you know, and that one thing that Chuck Missler really instilled in me was an interest in Bible prophecy. That was one of the things that he emphasizes, you know, how do you know that this is really a revelation from God?
Yeah.
It's because it predicts the future in advance, and you can prove that to yourself if you study it. So I took him up on that challenge, and I really dug in and did prove that to myself. And the more that I did prove it to myself, the more interested I am in it. And, you know, some of the research for this book came from a paper I did for Church History on eschatology. I addressed that there's a whole, if you look at from the Reformation, from Martin Luther up into the 20th century, most Protestants thought the papacy was the Antichrist. I mean, all of them did, really. Spurgeon, Jonathan Edwards, even John Wesley. I mean, all of them did. And so I wrote a paper about that, and that's what where Tom was getting into this idea that Edwards and them actually pointed to the year 2012. And that's true. I found that in a peer-reviewed journal article from a church history article from this research paper I did, that Edwards actually started the reign of Antichrist in 756, was one of his alternatives. And then he extrapolated the year 1260 years from Revelation chapter 12 as the time the woman was in the desert. They interpreted that as the church. So that lands in 2016. And then if you accept the 3.5-year tribulation period, that would put it beginning sometime in 2012, which is how we get the Jonathan Edwards reference in there. So that all came from, you know, research I did working on my master's degree.
Wow.
So, and the important part about this is that this is academic research. We would want people to know that this book, it's 600 pages long, but it has 800 authoritative endnotes, because we wanted to be very clear, very careful, that we were citing sources that are not, you know, spurious, and well, anyway, so I don't want to keep you from whatever your next question was, but it's really important to know that the research was done very well on this book. Oh, what I was going to say is that it isn't just evangelical scholars down through time who imagined that Rome would apostatize and become the seat of the Antichrist or the false prophet, but many, many Catholic writers and theologians said the same thing. Cardinal Manning is one of the better known names, but numerous Catholic writers foresaw that Rome would become the seat of the Antichrist in the end time, and as well as the most well-known church-accepted seers, Fatima, various revelations from, you know, Mary appearing to children, you know, And giving them these revelations seemed to be redundant, that over and over they saw the same thing, that Rome would become apostate and the throne of the Antichrist.
Well, isn't the third secret of Fatima involving a bishop who's going up a hill and essentially walking over the bodies of many of his fellow priests and bishops and cardinals?
Yeah, and actually, there's a significant portion of this book that deals with the fact that there probably was a significant cover-up in 2000 when the Vatican, Pope Paul, and the writers, by the way, at that time are all back in the center of controversy now. Cardinal Angelo Sodano, Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger, who's now Pope Benedict the 16th, Peter Bertoni, Peter the Roman there, the Secretary of State. These were all the people who actually put together the information that was presented to the world in the year 2000 as the final disclosure of the third secret of Fatima. And but many Catholics, including really well-known men like Antonio Socchi, who is a celebrity in Italy and a devout Catholic, saw that there was really a cover-up involved in the year 2000. And what's very strange now is all these poison pen letters, everything that's going on in the Vatican, is between the persons who were the main players in what is called the cover-up of Fatima. And so in our book, we spend a great deal of time talking about why that might be the case, and in fact what might be happening now as we approach the next conclave and the retirement or the assassination, some are saying, including some Catholic cardinals, of Benedict the 16th, and then the arrival of Petrus Romanus. One thing, by the way, I should make clear is that there is some confusion in some of the emails we're receiving. People are trying to tie specifically the name Petrus Romanus or Peter the Roman to who the next pope might be, and so they see Peter Bertoni, or they see Peter Turkson of Ghana, and they think that because those cardinals are papable, they've been named as being papable, they could be elected to be the next pope, and they're trying to tie whoever Peter the Roman is going to be directly to somebody who has the name Peter. But that is completely unnecessary, because if you study the prophecy of the popes that were ascribed to Malachy O'Morgair, he mostly speaks in terms of symbolism, and he will say something about a pope that then, once that pope is elected, can be identified to the pope. Like Pope Paul the VI is referred to as Flos Florum, or Flower of Flowers. And if you look at his heraldry, his coat of arms, it's got the three fleur-de-lis, the flower symbols used by the French monarchy. So that was mostly how he cast his prophecies, and they have been very, very accurate through Pope Benedict the 16th. So we might see something about Petrus Romanus that doesn't necessarily require his name, his Christian name, his birth name, to be Peter.
Well, you mentioned a minute ago, Tom, about a story that just came out about Pope Benedict possibly dying. I think you did. And if you didn't, it was just in my head. I got a question for either one of you. Is there some sort of infighting going on at the Vatican right now?
You'd want to go, Chris, but I can't.
I think Tom will be better on that than me.
Yeah, well, there's something extraordinary going on in the Vatican right now. I don't hardly have enough room at Reuters News Update to put the headlines up every day, and even some of the Catholics' own newspapers and newspapers like the Vatican Watcher and Insider and those type papers that are they're owned by Catholics. They typically write news that would ingratiate people to the Vatican, and they've been writing some fairly incredible stuff over there right now about poison pen letters. Cardinal Vagano, his letters indicating that he was prematurely removed from the office of the Secretary General of the Government there of Vatican City, and given this job of nuncio or ambassador to the United States specifically to remove him from Rome because he was trying to clean up, the Vatican's contracts and their banking policies, because the Vatican is hoping to get on the so-called white list of banks, and he was prematurely removed. He didn't finish out his office, and according to those letters that then got published about a month ago, It was because Bertone was, you know, making sweet deals, you know, inside the banking system, corruption, mm-hmm. nepotism, cronyism. But in order to give preferred contracts at inflated prices to some of his friends who also hold offices there inside the Holy See and work inside the Vatican City. And so now all of a sudden you've got these news agencies like Reuters out there talking about how there's kind of a mutiny of the Monsingers that's playing out behind the scenes, and most of it directed towards Cardinal Bertone and his supporters. But what most of the public doesn't know is, you know, who is considered to be the most likely primary source of these leaked documents to the press that are casting so much negative light on Bertone. And most of the watchers of the Vatican say that it's happening as a result of Cardinal Angelo Sodano, who is an influential power broker there in the Vatican that served with Pope John Paul II for 15 years. But Sodano is the one who gave, to answer your question, Sharon, he's the one who in 2000 gave that little speech that said the Pope, the bishop dressed in white, who falls down among all those dead bodies in the city half destroyed, the Fatima revelation, that he was only apparently dead. And then they tied it to the assassination attempt against John Paul II. And so what you have are all of the primary players of the Fatima cover-up are back now. And what are they doing? You know, they're lobbying, they're using the media to lob these grenades at one another to cast negative light on who probably are the most palpable persons in line for the next conclave. So there's a power struggle that's going on, but at the root of it, the purpose behind it is to try to influence those cardinals that have voting power, the College of Cardinals, because they're not going to want to elect somebody that might have a whole lot of negative media around them. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to elect somebody who will follow a particular agenda and who is palpable, but also, you know, and by the way, I don't think Timothy Dolan has a chance, but that's the kind of a person they would be looking for, this new cardinal that was just elevated, yeah, you know, last week in the consistory. Timothy Dolan, he came there and gave his big speech, and everybody applauded him. I shouldn't have said he was raised to a cardinal then, but he spoke at the consistory, and now you see the New York Times and all of them talking about how he might become the first American pope. I don't think that's going to happen, but what I'm saying is a conclave is going to want to elect somebody that's got a lot of positive media around them. And therefore, to keep somebody from, like Bertone, becoming the next pope, you want to try to create a lot of negative energy. In fact, there was some kind of a headline today, I forget what it even was, but talking about Bertone left the Vatican to get away from the poison atmosphere there, and so he visited a hospital.
So with these political machinations behind the scenes and the health of Pope Benedict either in question or somebody inside the Vatican raising concerns about a possible assassination attempt on Pope Benedict sometime this year. If, in fact, we do see the ascension of a pope that would be identified as Peter the Roman, what do we expect? What are some of the corroborating sources that you pulled together, Chris, saying about this Peter the Roman and his time in office?
Well, you know, Derek, the whole prophecy of the popes, you know, to me, when I first looked at it, there was a few compelling things about it, but you know, I looked at it really critically, and you know, I didn't start out presupposing that this was a true prophecy. Quite the opposite. What I did is I really tried to debunk it, and and I figured that, you know, I needed to take that kind of attitude with it, and be really critical, because I didn't want to just go into this, you know, wide eyed, you know, just trying to write a book with a bunch of special pleading, you know, and I've read books like that really kind of stretch history, trying to make the prophecies sound true. I
mean, and all the sources linked to websites that link to other websites
Right. Some of the Latin phrases to me aren't all that compelling, but some of them really are. I mean, some of them are very compelling. And, you know, for that reason, I couldn't just brush it aside. So, you know, I started, you know, okay, I took a class in hermeneutics in seminary, which is, you know, biblical scholarship. And, you know, one of the things they teach us is learning, you know, to read the context is really important. And so I'll just do an example that I use in the book is the kind of the way I approach this prophecy is that, like, when we read the Gospels, we know that, you know, these are real historical events that occurred with Jesus. And yet the gospel writer wrote about it maybe 20 years after, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's actually two layers of context there. You have, you know, the actual historical events, and then you have the context of the author himself, okay? And so, like, when we study the Gospels, they teach us that, you know, this is real history that happened, but there's also, you can detect an evangelistic agenda that the author has. So you might notice that Luke arranges the order of events differently than Matthew or something mm-hmm. like that. And that doesn't mean that, you know, the history isn't real. It just means that they both arranged it differently. So that's the different layer of context between Matthew and Luke. But, I mean, they're still talking about real history. They just arranged it in a different order. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, when I look at this prophecy, there's a lot of controversy with it, and a lot of Jesuits have written books about it. And I mean, there's a ton of literature, and most of it's in foreign languages. So I was having to translate a lot. And but what you see is you see a lower level of context and an upper layer of context. And the first publication of this prophecy was in 1595 by this guy Wyon. And that's really the only one the oldest one that I could put my hands on and look at. We actually reproduce it in the book. And, you know, it's all in Latin, and you can tell that it's interpreted up until 1590. Like, it has an explanation for the Latin phrase, and it even puts the Pope's name up until this date. Now, because that's the oldest one that most people have seen, they think that right after that, the very next one, there was a conclave, and the prophecy was from the old city, okay? And it just so happens that there's this a Jesuit named Meinstrier, and what his hypothesis is basically that there was a candidate for the Pope named Simon Selle, and from the old city, which was the prophecy, would match. He was the cardinal of a city called Orvieto, which actually means old city.
Huh.
So they think that they altered that one. This is their theory because they were trying to get this guy elected. And if you read the Wikipedia article or most of the popular literature out there, it'll talk about this conspiracy to get this one Simon Selle guy elected. And so they think that all the prophecies before that were altered. And there's really good evidence that they were. And I'll explain why. There was a history of the popes by a guy named Panvinius. Mm-hmm. It was the reference work at the time. And it went up to like 1557, 1560, something like that. But we can look at the text of the prophecy, and there's interpretations that Wyon had written down,
mm-hmm.
and they follow Panvinius' book to the T. And the dead giveaway is that Panvinius made some mistakes in his book, like on the heraldry, you know, the coats of arms mm-hmm. for certain popes. He actually made some errors. Well, the funny thing is that if you look at the prophecies of the popes here that was supposedly composed in 1139, the same errors that are in Panvinius' book are in the prophecy. So it's kind of a dead giveaway that somebody copied his book. And the same anti-popes are there. Now, that's a really powerful argument, too, because, and, you know, anti-popes are, you know, popes that somebody that was elected opposed to the other pope. And there were several of them throughout history. And the thing that's unusual is that the pre-1590 section of the Malachi prophecy has the same anti-popes as Panvinius' book. But there were actually more antipopes. Panvinius didn't account for all of them. So, you know, it's just really odd that the prophecy coincides so closely to his book, but not really to actual history. And it's kind of a dead giveaway that someone altered it. Now, the thing is, going back to this concept of two layers of context, there's really no reason that anyone would create this whole prophecy and extend it out 112 popes up into 2012, you know, to influence a conclave in 1590. That doesn't make any sense. So what we believe, you know, and all the scholars that I studied, I read a lot of different books by different Jesuits and things, and Rene Thiebaud is the big one that we'll probably get to, because he really believed in the prophecy. We detect that there is an authentic layer of context in the prophecy, and you know, that it's a real prophecy, but it got altered. And you know, from my study of church history and the Vatican's practices, they have a long record of taking old documents and altering them for their own purposes. Unfortunately, they've done a lot of that. So this is not really shocking that that happened. But so we have this lower level of context, which is the original document, and it could have been by St. Malachi. No one really knows that, maybe. Or it could have been, some people think it was Nostradamus, which would be a good possibility. Or somebody anonymous completely. I don't know. But, you know, through all the different sources I looked at, there's some evidence that actually people did have a copy of this around 1570. Some people say 1560. It shows up in some people. There's some quotes in some of the literature that show that it was around before 1590, which mm-hmm. is the common, you know, conspiracy theory that you hear.
Which makes it possible that it could have been Nostradamus. He died about 1566. So, okay.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So it was at least around. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a Catholic scholar named John Lupia. And he claims that it was published around 1557. Now, I haven't been able to see the document that he's talking about, but he seems pretty unbelievable on that. He thinks that this guy, Panvinius, is the one that actually discovered the old document, and that would make sense. So, I mean, the best that I can piece it together is this Panvinius, the same guy that wrote the book I was talking about, found the old document. I don't know who was in on the conspiracy and exactly how that worked. But the whole thing with Simon Selle, I don't know that that's even true. That's just what most people say, because there's another book that I found that was supposedly lost to history that John Hoax had burned up in a monastery, and I found that book, and you know, there was some drama that went on with that. I got it through interlibrary loan from Yale University, and that book actually says the author of that book says that he researched the conclave where the Simon Selle thing supposedly happened, and it never happened. Nobody even voted for Simon Selle. So it's kind of odd that they altered the prophecy for this big conspiracy to get this guy elected, and he wasn't really even a live candidate. So
Go ahead, Tom.
What the evidence illustrates, and not just from our research, but other persons who have spent a great deal of time trying to track down the origin of the prophecy of the popes, what is illustrated is that they're around Simon Selle, that whoever had got their hands on the original document before it was published in Lignum Vatae, that it somebody messed with it, and probably for political reasons. Could have been they were trying to get a particular pope. They wanted to make the voters, in other words, believe that he was prophesied to be the pope, and therefore they needed to follow this Catholic prophecy in voting somebody in who could fulfill it. So they altered the original document to try to get somebody elected. Something happened, but what's amazing about the document is that from that time and forward, once it was published, the remaining 500 years of prophecies appear to feel different, they look different, and these prophecies are actually becoming more accurately fulfilled as time went on, which then again raises the question. When you get prophecies like this that we can verify are 80 to 90% accurate, then you want to start wondering, okay, is this divinely inspired? Mm-hmm. Is it demonically inspired? But there's a third level, and that could be that people inside the Vatican, voters inside the Vatican, they had this prophecy, and they kept it concealed in the Vatican archives for hundreds of years until it was finally published. And it could just simply be that the cardinals are voting in persons that they believe could be represented as fulfilling this prophecy, and that raises a whole different kind of question. What do they think of it, or why would they be following like a roadmap to select popes in particular that could fulfill this prophecy? So the game here actually gets even more intriguing as you look into it. And maybe before the end of the broadcast, Chris can also tell you how he tracked down the French Codex by Rene Thiebaud, because I think that's probably one of the highlights of the whole book. But let me just say this. Nobody is going to read the book, Petrus Romanus, the Final Pope, is here, and not understand who at least I think the likely candidate for Petrus Romanus is going to be. But the bigger point is that whoever is elected is Petrus Romanus. That's the end of the elections. I mean, that's the end of the prophecy. The last pope on the list of this 900-year-old prophecy is going to appear. Now, here's the most likely candidates. Francis Arendse is, according to some Catholic prophets, like Ronald L. Conti Jr., is his best pick for Petrus Romanus. But Arendse, the last time around in 2005, when Benedict was elected, he was papable. In fact, he received some votes and got outvoted by Ratzinger. But he's getting on in age, and I don't think he's going to be the pope that's going to take the role of Petrus Romanus. Tarsicio Bertone, Peter Bertone, I would have bet you money 2 months ago that he absolutely was going to be Peter the Roman, and for very particular reasons, mostly having to do with his relationship with Ratzinger, going back all the way back way before, actually, the whole Fatima cover-up thing that happened in the year 2000. They've been friends for a long time, but they have intentionally been stacking the deck, the red hats, in favor of Bertone. If you look at the people, even in the 22 bishops who were upgraded to red hats just here 2 or 3 weeks ago, most of them are Europeans, most of them are Italians, many of them are friends of Bertone, who already have very powerful positions within the Vatican City. And that's been going on for the last three consistories. And in fact, the best Vatican watchers, the most legendary Vatican watchers, are all redundantly saying that behind the scenes, this is obviously the influence of Peter Bertone through Pope Benedict to put into position of power for the next conclave people who are friends or people who would most likely be to vote for him because he's also an Italian. So, but the game has started changing radically in the last few weeks, and there's something even deeper than that going on. But let me finish this quick list. Peter Turkson of Ghana, Angelo Scola, Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi, Leonardo Sandri, Ennio Antonelli, Jean-Louis Taran, however you say his name, Christophe Schoenbern, I think he's actually a Canadian, or Mark Goulet, I think, is the Canadian. But that's the most likely 10 according to the, I forget what his name is, but he's a father who provides a list of the most palpable names going back for some years now in numerous elections, and almost every time has had a selection in the top 10 that actually got elected as the pope. And so that's the top 10 players. If I had to tell you today who I think Petrus Romanus is going to be, I would still pick Tarsicio Bertone, but his chances are going down day by day because of something else that's going on under the radar there in the Vatican City. And what I was going to respond to was this question about Nostradamus. Having all of that in mind, there's something that every one of these papal contenders may want to consider, and that is how not just New Agers, but many Catholics actually believe that the 16th century seer who wrote the prophecy of the popes was Nostradamus. And if that is so, there's a point that was made recently by the National Catholic Reporter concerning West African Cardinal Peter Turkson and how that he's young. He's in his 60s, and that's real young in terms of electability. I think he's 63 or 64. And that might have a way of coming back around because he's not really a dark horse candidate, and his ideas for a one-world financial and political authority housed in the United Nations, you know, that whole thing that was published here last year, I think that could become a remarkable, even unexpected fulfillment of the prophecy of the popes and or Nostradamus' prediction because Nostradamus actually predicted that in the end times a young black cardinal would be elected pope, but the way he writes about it feels like it is a conspiracy that somebody else should have been elected. This guy winds up being elected, and that matches very well with a lot of end time prophecies by Catholics who see that the end times pope, that there's going to be some shenanigans going on, and that in fact the person who should have been pope, you know, might have been like the 58 and 63 conclaves where Siri was allegedly elected, and his election was set aside, or he agreed not to take it. The prophecy of Nostradamus feels very much that way when he predicts that a young black pope is going to seize control of the Roman hierarchy with the assistance of conspirators. And here's what it says in Quatrain 625 from Nostradamus, quote, "Through Mars adverse," that means a time of war, "will be the monarchy of the great fisherman," that is the pope, "in trouble ruinous, a young black red," that is a young black cardinal, "will seize the hierarchy, the predators acting on a foggy day," end quote. So there is a prophecy in Nostradamus that during a time of global tribulation, the pope is going to fall into ruin. Does that mean he's assassinated? I don't know, but as a result, a young black cardinal seizes the hierarchy, and right now, the most likely young black cardinal, if that prophecy is to be believed, would probably be Cardinal Turkson. Peter, and his name also just happens to be Peter.
You know, it's really interesting. Before we actually started recording this, you and we were all talking about a 12th century saint called Saint Hildegard, even though she was never actually canonized. She's referred to as Saint Hildegard, but she had predicted something similar. She said that the last pope would be someone who had taken, essentially stolen the papacy and had been previously a Muslim. Had either of you read anything that came along lines like that?
Sharon, I did. I was looking into Catholic prophecy, and like I was telling you before the show, I sort of had planned to write a chapter about some of these prophecies in the book, but in the interest of time, I didn't have time to write that chapter, but I did research it. I bought some books on Catholic prophecy, and over Christmas, I read this one by Yves DuPont, and it just lists a lot of these prophecies. And, you know, one of the things that really stood out to me is that a lot of these The Catholic eschatology has like this great monarch person who sounds like he's like a king of France, is the way they talk about him in these prophecies, that appears and basically establishes a kingdom and kind of like makes it, enforces Catholicism, and the whole world kind of converts. And the thing is interesting is they have this guy appearing before the Antichrist and before the end times. And, you know, When I read that, it seems to me that that's setting them up to think that the great monarch and think the Antichrist is the great monarch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that same thing. But really quickly, because we're running out of time, I have one more question for you, and then Derek can ask his questions. Do you think it's possible that what we've seen of the infighting in Vatican taking place, that someone or some group might be trying to force the hand of the next election? In other words, we need to get that Petros Romanos in there in 2012, because that's when everybody's looking for a big shift in the world dynamic?
Well, I absolutely do. And I also would say that regardless of, you know, how much stock we may put into Catholic prophecies, the Catholics themselves, and including the prophecy of the popes, is held in esteem by some people inside the Vatican. Some of the research that we found, including this book by René Thibault, he was a Jesuit, so he was no Johnny-come-lately. He was actually an academic and worked in university and was an author, and he absolutely believed in the prophecy of the popes. And furthermore, through very complicated methodologies, I mean mathematical, cryptographical, amigrammatical, he used a lot of different ways in which he approached this subject matter, and he determined over 60 years ago that Petros Romanos would arrive in April 2012. By the way, there's a group of, if you've seen Raiders News Update today, we've got a video over there about an upcoming film documentary, and I think it's called the Torah Code 2012, something like that. But now you've got those same rabbis in Jerusalem who were the original personalities behind the Bible Code, and they say that they have a provable mathematical codex that they have found that has showed that the Jewish Messiah is going to appear in April 2012. So this is, again, kind of goes back to what I said earlier about there seems to be some kind of occult activity. There's something occurring, and not just the Maya, but of course the Maya also look to it, but these church fathers, Marian apparitions, Catholic seers down through time, and they forecast that when we reached that time, just before or at the beginning of the tribulation, the arrival of Petrus Romanus is the way the Malachi Omorgair prophecy puts it, that there would be an upset in terms of who would be elected as the pope, and that pope would be under the influence of Satan and would be the false prophet of biblical fame and would give rise to the Antichrist. St. Francis of Assisi, I mean, he is a very venerated religious figure. And before he died, he gathered his followers together and told them the same thing. And then one of the prophecies that we refer to in our book, Petrus Romanus, The Final Pope is Here, has to do with Father Herman Bernard Kramer, who was a very well-respected Catholic academic. And he wrote the book called The Book of Destiny, in which he provides this frightening prophecy and this strange interpretation of the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation concerning the great wonder mentioned in verse 1 of that chapter out of Revelation. I don't know if I have time to read that to you, but all of those prophecies indicate that the man of sin is going to arrive as some kind of chaotic circumstances during the next conclave.
So it appears as though if these prophecies are in any way accurate or even close to accurate, that we are headed for a bumpy ride.
We're suddenly hearing all sorts of echoes here.
Yeah, we're getting a bit of an echo. I wonder if, Chris, have you turned your speakers up on your end?
No.
Oh, okay. Like we just maybe just let you talk. So
it's
we don't
because
get
Tom Horn is on here with us. He always messes things up.
I do. Yes. I heard that for a moment, but it seems better now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, now it is.
Well, there's a question let me set this aside for just a moment. I want to because there are a couple that I'm really
unless
curious
we're gonna
about.
Unless we're going to go 2 hours long, yeah. we're almost to done with the first hour.
Yeah, about 10 minutes left in our time together as we talk with Chris Putnam and Tom Horn about Petrus Romanus, the final pope, is here. Let me throw this to you, Chris, first, but I'd like you both to answer this. You both approach this from a position of skepticism. Tom, you mentioned you only touched on it in your book, Apollyon Rising 2012, didn't give it much much ink. Chris, you approached this as a skeptic, attempting to debunk the St. Malachi prophecies. What was it, Chris, that changed your mind and began to convince you that there was something to this prophecy?
Okay. Well, Derek, you know, the first one that really caught my attention was the phrases match up to the popes, and there's one, religio depopulata, okay? And that one fell on the reign of Benedict the 15th from September 3, 1914 to like January 1922, okay? Now, you know, in science, like the way they prove a theory is they try to falsify it. And they say, you know, a theory is not really a good theory unless it's falsifiable, unless it makes risky predictions. And that's the kind of things I was looking for in this prophecy. Some of them are vague, you know, but this one is not vague. I mean, it means religion depopulated. Okay, so if the Catholic Church had experienced unprecedented growth or just remained the same, then this prophecy would have been falsified from that phrase. But this time is the very time in history when the Catholic Church experienced the biggest losses it ever has, ever. I mean, ever since, because this is when you had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, mm-hmm. where you have atheistic communism just destroying churches and imprisoning all the Christians. It's the time the World War I started, which was devastating to Roman Catholicism. So you just see like millions of people leaving the church right during the papal reign of this phrase, religio depopulata. That really, I just couldn't get away from how accurate that was. And knowing that we have a documented copy, at least at 1595, you know, and we're looking at something that happened in the 20th century that, you know, is that dead on accurate. And then there's some other ones that are pretty amazing. If you look at John Paul II, he, you know, they say that one thing I wanted to mention, Tom mentioned the one earlier about heraldry, the coats of arms.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking that through. Like I said, I really tried to examine this stuff critically. You know, you would think that, well, what if the Pope just chose a coat of arms that matched the prophecy, right? That's the kind of thinking that I went through. But I examined the customs, and they actually have laws in the Catholic Church about heraldry. When you become elected a cardinal, you are required to pick your heraldry and select it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so most of these guys are elected a cardinal 20, 30 years before they become Pope. So to think that, you know, they could, you know, think that they were going to be Pope and pick a heraldry matching the prophecy is really, it isn't possible. I mean, the timing would be really difficult to pull off, because you could pick one, the next one on the prophecy, and then there'd be another Pope, and then, uh-huh, you know, it wouldn't work. So I really thought I'll throw a lot of this critically, and there's a lot of ones that match the heraldry, like, to a T, very amazingly. But John Paul II, this is one that was really impressive to me. It's from the labor of the sun, okay, in Latin, de labor solis.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, okay, at first it's vague. You know, like what Tom said, some of these are symbolic, and they don't really make sense until after the fact. But John Paul II was born during an eclipse. Okay, and I went to NASA and verified it on his birthday, and it's there. I mean, and it's all documented in the book. I even have a link where you can go to the NASA website and check it out yourself. I mean, that Latin phrase, I mean, it can, some people transfer it as eclipse from the sun, mm-hmm, or pregnancy of the sun, or travails of the sun. I mean, it could read that way. But yeah, he was not only born during eclipse. Now, this is even weirder. He was buried during an eclipse. Okay.
Hmm.
And so from the labor of the sun, I mean, I don't know.
And he was very much a Marian Pope. He made the worship of Mary central to his entire reign as Pope. And it's interesting because when you have an eclipse, the moon, Our Lady, the female, mm-hmm, aspect, overshadows the male aspect of the sun. In fact, overshadows, you may even say, God, because there are some who say that the sun represents God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you that the whole Marian phenomenon to me is disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a chapter on that as well. And we don't have time to go into it thoroughly, but I think that there's a great deal of deception going on with the Marian thing. And, you know, I don't know. I guess we don't really have time to get into it. But, I mean, the book has a whole chapter on that, and
no, we can do another program on that. That'll give us plenty.
We need
to,
but you know what? Bringing that up, it takes to a question that actually I think Derek was about to ask you anyway.
Yeah, there is a question that pops up every time we do a show that relates to the Roman Catholic Church, one way or the other. We're either accused of bashing Catholics or being supporters of Roman Catholicism. Mm-hmm. Tom, let me put this in your court, because there are some who have asked us, in fact, with the publication of the apocryphal books that you've put out through Defender Publishing, what is your position on the doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church?
Well, certainly I'm not a Catholic, and I think we're going to answer that question big time with the publishing of this book, Petrus Romanus, The Final Pope Is Here, because half of the chapters deal with heretical issues that are directly connected to the dogma of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But my position has always been that I am not a Catholic basher, but I am a truly evangelical believer. And there are some stark differences in my belief system from Roman Catholicism. It's just that I'm not generated by hatred. And so what happens is you have some people out there that they cannot even imagine that a devout Catholic could love the Lord and be saved. They can't even imagine that would be possible.
That's
so
true.
Period. If you go into a Catholic church, period, you're on your way to hell. And I don't take that position. But I do believe that I believe the Rome, I believe their dogma, is going to give rise to the Antichrist and to the false prophet. And that is why the way this book is written was to be written in such a way that Catholics themselves will be able to read their own mystics, their own seers, their own prophets, who all, for hundreds of years, thousands of years, have actually forecast that the day would come when the final pope would arrive. And according to Malachi Omorgair's prophecy, he's named Petrus Romanus, Peter the Roman. And I think that that name actually implies that he is going to reassert Roman authoritarianism, such as existed before Vatican II. So there's a lot to this book, but I took that approach specifically because I don't want this research to just, I don't want Catholics to throw it aside and say, oh, it's just Catholic bashing, because it's not. In fact, we have a preface to the book in which we very much explain where we are coming from. So I don't know if I answered your question.
You answered it absolutely good.
Perfectly.
Chris, let me throw that to you. The skeptics will look at it as just Catholic bashing, as will members of Roman Catholic Church, or some will anyway. There will be others who will say you portray the final pope, Peter the Roman, as the Antichrist, as evil, as though the previous popes had not somehow perpetuated some of these heretical doctrines or non-scriptural doctrines. What would your response be?
Well, Derek, when people read the book, that will not be an issue, I promise you. I just finished graduate school getting my master's degree in theology. I went out and bought Catholic systematic theology books for this project, and I critique Catholic doctrine line by line on some of their major ones in detail from a very Protestant Reformed perspective. Okay, so no one's going to accuse us of abandoning Protestantism and adopting Catholic doctrines. We point out the problems in it. And, you know, we also are very careful to say that, you know, I don't believe that all Catholics are not Christians by any means. I think there are many Christians in the Catholic
Amen.
Church. I certainly do. But I think that a lot of them are in spite of their leadership. And there's very specific reasons why I think that. And, you know, they're laid out in detail in the book. And
let me jump in here, Chris, and add, we also do the same thing with evangelical Christianity,
right.
Dominionism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There is stark idolatry that occurs within the evangelical church as well. There's one chapter in there, or at least a subchapter, that's titled something like Petrus Romanus and his Dominionist pals, or something like that.
Ooh,
So we're talking about the difference, though, between individual persons and their true and devout faith in Christ and salvation through him alone and his finished work. The difference between that and institutions historically become corrupt, whether they're evangelical, Catholic, or the government of the United States of America. Institutions over time become corrupt, and there is corruption in these various institutions now that I think people are going to be surprised, because, by the way, The accuracy of the majority of the prophecies in the Prophecy of the Popes are startling. And we want people to know, however, that this book is not about that prophecy. There are several chapters. There's amazing findings in this book, like René Thibault, that point to the year 2012. Numerous other things that point to the year 2012 and the arrival of Petrus Romanus. But actually, this book takes a wider investigation into the Vatican, into Washington. It's not looking at individuals on a personal level. We're talking about international, very powerful agencies, political authorities, and the bigger question of whether or not the false prophet and the Antichrist are here. And I'm telling you right now that that people should not approach this book haphazardly. I said that on Steve Quayle's show the other night. Because if they do, there are going to be people that are going to have a real crisis in their faith. This book's going to trouble them because of the parts that we're not talking about on these radio shows. But I think, and this is why I said, by the way, it's the most important thing I've ever written. I think we are at a very portentous moment in time now.
I think we're down to days. I really do. But we are down to seconds, in fact, on the show, and so we need to know how to get the book.
The book will be it will be in print in April 2012. It's already right now tracking in the top 100 new books at Amazon. I think this book is going to be explosive for a lot of different reasons, but we're going to do something through Raiders that Amazon or nobody else is going to do. We're creating a collection, René Thibault's book in French and in English, and numerous other sources that were required to write this book, and we're going to make all of that library free to people, but they're going to have to get it directly from us because Amazon won't do that.
Awesome.
But it'll be available in April.
Are you going to make a Kindle version, please?
We will, but because of our agreement with Survivor Mall and some of the ministries, see, we highly discount our books to ministries like mm-hmm. Southwest Radio Church, Prophecy in the News, and we give them the first 90 days mm-hmm. to do shows, to be able to sell the book because it supports their ministry. And if we put it out on Kindle at the same time, it really hurts their ministry.
Well,
we're really more ministry-oriented than we are revenue-oriented, so we do it that way, and then 90 days later, it'll be on Kindle.
Okay, so maybe this fall. You know, if it comes out in April of this year, there may be a new pope in place by then. Who knows?
Well, there's been news agencies that have been suggesting the same. The pope's being wheeled around right now on a cart everywhere he goes. Hmm. He is getting weaker, and he has hinted that he may retire, and his birthday's in April, and he may retire during his birthday in April. But in any case, it's imminent, and so we just feel this real sense of urgency. That's why some of those chapters that Chris wanted to write, we just simply didn't have time to do it.
And, if you go to my website right now, I have a chart that shows the simplest calculation that René Thibault used to derive 2012, and it explains in detail how he arrived at April based on just the average papal reign from the authentic portion of the prophecy. And it's published at logosapologia.org right now. And you can go look at that chart, and it'll give you an idea. But I promise you, there's like five or six other calculations where he derives the same date that are in the book. So just one way to verify it.
Code breakers and mathematicians, people that like to break anagrams, they're going to just love this research that Chris Putnam did in that regard. But, of course, now you have rabbis out of Israel saying that the Torah says that they're their Messiah, which would be the false Messiah to us, the Antichrist, because they rejected Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to appear in April. You've got the Zohar we've talked about before. So,
We could even get into the recent Madonna thing. I mean, we just don't have time to get into so much stuff. We'll need to bring you back.
We barely scratched the surface, but we'll put links in the show notes to website of Chris Putnam, logosapologia.org, and I'll link to the first in the nine parts so far about Petros Romanos, The Final Pope Is Here, written by Tom Horn at newswithviews.com, and you can follow through from part one through part nine there, I believe. And Tom, Chris, once again, thank you for your time this afternoon. We're just sorry that we can't compress more into an hour, but of course we do that, then we could just do an audio series rather than actually asking people to go to your websites and pick up copies of the book.
Hey, Derek and Sharon, so wonderful to always be on with you. And hey, Chris, talk to you later.
All right. Nice to talk to you again,
You
Tom.
Guys hang on the line. Right. Music's coming up.
All right. Again, check the show notes at PIDradio.com. We appreciate your time. And as always, until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content, copyright Gilbert House, and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. clear. A better day is coming soon.